Yes, okay, so our next presenters will be, I have Parker Fischel, is an archivist, researcher, and writer. He graduates this spring from the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also a product of Columbia University and its radio station WKCR-FM. Across the public and private sector, he's worked in various capacities with American cultural collections, ranging from Bob Dylan's archives to the UT Folklore Center archives, to the collections of jazz musicians like Juma Sultan and Jolie Wilson. He's presently working on a biodiscography of Marion Brown. After 4 years as a DJ and board member at WKCR-FM in New York and a summer internship at Dust to Digital, Sophie Abramowitz spent 2.5 years as the archival assistant at the Alan Lomax Archive. Currently a first-year PhD student at the University of Virginia, studying late 19th and early 20th century American literature, culture, and music, she is about to begin an oral history project surrounding the town of Vienna, Virginia. And look at that, I think we're ready to go.
Great. We already got introduced, but Sophie and I are very pleased to be here presenting for a distinguished cast of characters about some work we've been doing for the past 5 years. And actually, it's perfect timing because this is the 45th anniversary year of the 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival. And so we're very pleased to present this work, which is coming to its end, or its near end. It always sort of continues. While we did this, we represent sort of these other institutions. This work was really done under the auspices of WKCR-FM, which is Columbia University's non-commercial educational radio station. And it couldn't have happened probably anywhere else. So we have to thank up front all the support that we've received from that community. So what was the 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival? It was a 3-day event running from Friday, August 1st, to Sunday, August 3rd, 1969, held at the Fuller Flatlands on the University of Michigan campus. And for $14, a person could see 24 headlining acts across daily concerts, a Saturday afternoon of workshops, and a midnight jam session at the Michigan Union Ballroom after Friday night's performances. Planned by student volunteers, the festival was sponsored by the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, in particular, the University Activities Committee and the Canterbury House. Through the dedicated vision and work of these students, what the university initially saw as an afternoon event featuring local blues rock bands morphed into the definitive blues festival. Perhaps Rolling Stone put it best when they titled an article co-written by Ed Ward and the festival's PR chair, Bert Stratton, "What's it like to be a 19-year-old college kid, totally inexperienced as a festival organizer, promoter, suddenly to find a full-scale blues festival growing out of your daydreams in Ann Arbor?" This is a list of the artists who performed at that first festival, and you can kind of see it's a who's who at the time. There are obviously many more who didn't quite make it, but many of them show up the next year at the 1970 festival. We're going to play a clip of Big Bill Hill, who was the MC, announcing Saturday or Sunday evening's lineup. And Big Bill Hill was a local disc jockey in Chicago on WOPA and the owner of the Copacabana Club on the west side of Chicago. And with ties to many of the performers, not just those that were Chicago-based, Big Bill Hill was a natural fit to be MC of the festival and was sort of indicative of the laid-back, relaxed atmosphere that the organizers were trying to cultivate. So here is Big Bill Hill reading Sunday afternoon's lineup, and he's announcing it right after the tail end of T-Bone Walker's set.
Don't give me no ice, man. T-Bone Walker, give me a cup with 2 pieces of ice in it. Let's get together and give wonderful, great T-Bone Walker.
Yeah, yeah.
Another round of applause. Everybody's here. Let me look over my list again. 2 little small pieces of ice and a great big 8-ounce cup. Big Mama Thornton is up next, Sammy Lane.
Oh, wow.
Big Joe Williams, lightning. Leiden and Strachan Hopkins. I don't know what this Memphis means. Memphis who? Sunhouse, Magic Sam, James Cotton, all the way from Texas. Huh? All the way from Texas. Big Freddie King will take us out tonight. Big Freddie King all the way from Texas.
So you can get a sense of the local color, and also sort of, I mean, if you just went to see that last little bit of the concert, it would be quite a show in and of itself. So let's have you take it.
So whether or not Ann Arbor was the first blues festival is debatable. For example, there is the Memphis Country Blues Festival, which showcased regional talent and white blues rock like Canned Heat, and the traveling European tour that was the American Folk Blues Festival. And while the importance of these events is inarguable, they operated with a different focus, concept, and scale than Ann Arbor did. The festival was different in that organizers wanted to showcase blues from different styles, time periods, and places. The loose concept was a history of the music and a space for that music to be presented on its own terms. While the blues had been a part of folk productions and more recently rock shows, at Ann Arbor, the blues reemerged from under these umbrellas with an identity of its own.
So the collection we were working with is the Jim and John Fischel collection, and the connection there is that my uncle John Fischel was the entertainment co-chair of the festival in 1969, and by dint of that connection, my dad and his friends found themselves at the festival, volunteered as minders for the artists. So specifically, my dad and his friends were responsible for Mississippi Fred McDowell and Arthur Big Boy Crudup. Between their duties of seeing that the artists were fed, arrived to the festival site, and were provided with adequate libations, they also managed to record about half the festival, which is about 16 and a half hours, as well as about an hour and a half of Fred McDowell performing for a small audience in his hotel room, which was just a room at the Michigan League student building, like the little union, and where he was sharing a room with Big Boy Crudup for a small audience that included his festival roommate, Crudup, my father, Bonnie Raitt, and Dick Waterman. So this collection, the Jim and John Fischel, represents the audio, photos, contracts with the artists, press clippings, and posters, but the sort of scope of our endeavor was all not just to preserve these materials, but also to establish intellectual control over all the other existing materials. So if there are other audio collections, press clippings, where things pop up, just to kind of figure out what would constitute the whole body of materials that would make up sort of an abstract 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival archive.
So our project began in 2009 at the WKCR studios in New York City, and it involved a rotating team of 4 to 5 students at any given period, with Parker and I more or less always included. And we began by dubbing 6 of the tape generations, which is about 16 and a half hours of footage per generation, or roughly 100 hours of footage uncatalogued, raw, to begin with. I'm sorry, of material. And the next leg of the project, content identification, took about 2 years of listening comparisons and some pretty extensive research. Through this, we were able to identify the performers and song titles for nearly all of the recordings that we have. Because each tape generation contained varying lengths of material, our next step was to do content and sound comparisons between all of our series. And from this, we identified the source that we believe, because of its completeness and because of the sound quality, is closest to the first tape generation. And here is a chart of what we've come up with, beginning with the Scotch series and ending with Columbia.
So once we'd sort of done all the background to decide upon the best source master, we went through a basic digitization process. And for those of you who have done that, the creation of preservation masters was pretty straightforward. We then went ahead and did an all-analog restoration of the tapes with no compression, and we used a GML parametric EQ and a TubeTech parametric EQ to kind of bring a little bit of warmth to the recordings. Due to the amount of material we were working with and sort of the parameters of the project, we developed artist-specific EQ patterns to use across each artist set. The only material from this collection that has ever really seen the light of day is a Magic Sam record called Live that you may own. It originally came out as a double LP set, and now I think it's a 2 CD set. And I can say this because my dad and my uncle, I think, did the mastering for that recording, but I think that we managed to one-up it, and that our restoration is much more accurate to the sounds as they would have been heard originally at the festival. Note also that it was the famous Hanley Sound who would go on to do the Woodstock Festival, who at that point were already distinguished as sort of doing large festival sound, large rock sound, and would go on to do Woodstock 2 weeks after the Ann Arbor Festival that did the mixing for the Blues Festival. So in the clip we'll play, you'll hear the audio from the Delmark LP release, and then you'll hear it immediately after the same clip from our restoration. Another thing I guess I want to say about sort of the audio process is that we kind of used what we might designate as the WKCR model, where students develop archival audio skills through hands-on work with the station's archives. I mean, throughout the project, we started this when I was 20 years old, Sophie was 19, and throughout the whole process, it was 18 to 22-year-olds who were working with these rare archival materials and doing this sort of heavy lifting. To kind of achieve that, Ben Young, who is the director of broadcasting and operations there and who has a background in things of this nature, taught workshops on open reel magnetic tape, audio comparison, mastering, which ensured that we had a certain degree of proficiency before we started handling the actual archival material, and that this sort of approximates, in a way, the old system of apprenticeship. And so not only were we training sort of a new generation of people, not just Ben, but then once we had a proficiency, passing that knowledge along to younger students, but we were building confidence and enthusiasm in these young people to go out and try and find their own Ann Arbor project to claim as their own. And it's also a model for a safe and productive model for dealing with all this audio that we have to deal with. So.
So after we finished that preservation process that Parker just talked about, the festival was still completely out of order. So the next thing we had to do was to reconstruct the festival. We wanted to identify all of the sidemen and make sure that we gave all the credit where credit was due. And we've been at it for a few years now and have gleaned most of our information from articles, festival reviews, and news blurbs. Barry Lee Pearson's books that include interviews done at the festival, Stanley Livingston's blues monograph, Blues in Black and White, and various archival collections, festival programs, and attendee notes. We've also found online platforms and social media to be particularly useful in this sort of research. So Blues Forums have filled in a couple blanks for us, and we've been able to identify a number of attendees and interviewees through postings on Facebook. We've also spent the past year or so working on an oral history project surrounding the festival. We've done 34 interviews so far, mostly by telephone, but in person when we can manage it. And they run for an hour and a half on average, but can go anywhere between 45 minutes and 3 hours each. And these are some of the more notable interviews that we've done so far, and this is an ongoing project.
So to quickly recap sort of the outputs, we have preserved and restored the audio, and also because we weren't working with the first generation, that's sort of lost to time. We were working with the best sound source. The material was all out of order, and so we had to kind of use both audio forensics and all this research to reconstruct the running order of the festival, and not only the running order of the festival, but the running order of the sets in some case, because they're disjointed and show up in different points. So we've nearly completed that. We've also nearly identified all the personnel, which has been pretty daunting. Some of these bands have, you know, all these horn players that just kind of showed up for a gig, so that's been a process as well. We have these oral history interviews that will contribute to the sort of collection. We've digitized all the photos, manuscripts, et cetera, from the Jim and John Fischel collection. We've compiled digital materials, so articles, reviews, advertisements, that can kind of also go along and supplement that material. And we've also created a bibliography about those materials, as well as sort of spreadsheets and other sorts of documentation that can gain or establish intellectual control of other existing collections so that if someone were to do something with this body materials, they would know where to look. So now we want to talk a little bit about what actually happened at the festival, what we've learned, and so we figured we'd use some vignettes to illustrate that. This is a great photo. Hopefully you can kind of see it. This is B.B. King, Mississippi Fred McDowell, Big Mama Thornton, Junior Wells, and Roosevelt Sykes. It's taken backstage on Friday night at the festival, and you can kind of weave a lot of narrative through a photo like this. So everyone was really enamored with B.B. King, who was just kind of bursting through, you know, had started to play things like the Fillmore West and was crossing over to this white popular audience. And if you notice, B.B. has a cassette recorder or player on his lap, and he was apparently so thrilled with his latest single that he wanted to share it with everyone. He was really excited and playing it for everyone backstage. And now, I don't know exactly what single that was, because in that year, he released two breakouts. It probably, The Thrill Is Gone was released in December of that year, and so it probably, in August, he hadn't probably recorded that yet. I'm guessing it was Why I Sing the Blues, which he had released earlier that summer, and which had already crept into the repertoires of many of the artists playing that festival, including Luther Allison. And which was also a new sound for B.B. King. B.B. was also quite taken with Fred McDowell, and if Fred's stage banter the next day is to be believed, he personally requested that Fred play his version of John Henry, because he found that to be quite enchanting. B.B. was perhaps most taken with Roosevelt Sykes, who was sort of a barrelhouse pianist and also a songwriter. He wrote Nighttime is the Right Time, and was sort of a bon vivant. And the two of them actually ended up teaming up later that night in what was the only sort of jam session of the festival at the Michigan Union Ballroom, where they kind of, I think they did a duet with both of them with guitar and piano, which was probably quite something. During his headlining set that night, B.B. brought his old friend Big Mama Thornton onto stage and wrapped his arm around her. And, you know, told everybody to stick around for Sunday's performance when she would team up with B.B.'s formative influence, Aaron T-Bone Walker, for a set that included a backing band called the Hound Doggers, after her big hit, Hound Dog. And then also Junior Wells played a Friday night set just before B.B. King with a set that was fairly representative of one of the approach that blues artists were taking to kind of court the younger rock audience, namely injecting the music with more funk and soul flavors and adopting a performance aesthetic similar to James Brown.
So the next thing we want to talk about is Barry Lee Pearson's master's and doctoral research, which he began at the 69 Ann Arbor Blues Festival. He did that research with kind of a notable method. Instead of recording the sets, he went backstage and recorded the artist conversations. Because of this research, published in Sounds So Good to Me, The Bluesman's Story, we're able to kind of sonify the photographs that we have of the festival.
I'll point that at everybody.
Okay. So Parker's going to point to who we're looking at. We see Mississippi Fred McDowell at the center. Where are you going? Big Joe Williams over there. And then there's Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf just behind him. And what's happening is Howlin' Wolf is just meeting Paul Osher for the first time. And Muddy Waters is chewing Howlin' Wolf out for playing his songs during his set. And while we can't verify that that's the exact conversation that's happening at this exact moment, it is kind of nice to be able to understand the atmosphere of the festival through two different kinds of medium.
And so those are both sort of the artists having fun backstage. And now we also want to actually talk a little bit about the music. And so the sort of three sets that a lot of people remember, there was the breakout set of Magic Sam, who's on the my far right, your far left, who showed up at the festival late and without a drummer, And apparently, you know, said to Sam Lay, hey, you want to hit it? And they went on stage and blew everybody away. And Sam died in December of that year. So this was sort of, and was just poised to break. It was rumored that he was going to sign with Stax. So this was a breakout set for him and could have set him up on a much more national scale, really. People also remember the grand entrance of Howlin' Wolf and his banter about the moon landing, which had happened not too distant past, along with the fact that he ran over on his time just to piss Muddy Waters off, who was headlining that night. But it was really Sunhouse here on the right here who generated the high drama of the festival. On Sunday evening, House was scheduled to perform before headliner James Cotton, who was going to close out the whole festival. But when the time came for House to go on stage, no one could find him. He was apparently off visiting kin in Detroit. So despite worries that when they finally did find House, despite the worries that he couldn't compete with the energy of James Cotton, the organizers acquiesced to the arguments of House's manager, Dick Waterman, and so Sunhouse came to close the 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival. So Waterman went to the stage and to introduce Sunhouse, and Waterman tells this great story about how at the time he stuttered, and he just got on stage in front of all those people, and he just spoke very eloquently, pleading with them, because they were all packing up to leave, because they, you know, either didn't know about Sunhouse or didn't whatever, pleading with them to stick around and stay. And so as people gathered their belongings and began to head to the cars, the festival ended where the blues began, and this is Sun talking at the beginning of his set.
We used to wouldn't know what the blues was until we wouldn't like to sing them, though, until late over in the evening years ago. You know, when I was a youngster and plying old mule. And then when the sun get slowly sinking down, and then it's nearby quitting time. And then, man, he get the blues then, because he know he going to see that old hen that night someplace. He going to be half tired. Now he got the blues, man, and he can home them, and the owls be hollering. You got the blues, and you can sing them too, man. You know, they didn't sing rock and roll too much.
So if Dick Waterman didn't have you and Sunhouse didn't have you with his intro, once the music started, more than one interview, he talked about how they stopped in their tracks, turned around, and went and sat down. And this is the beginning of that set. Even after 3 days of blues, that blew everybody away, and deservedly so. So talking a little bit higher level, perhaps more abstract, the sort of themes of what we've kind of learned and been able to compile, because although our focal point is 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival, it's really a point in really several narratives that are all intersecting. And so kind of putting it all together, what does it mean? Well, the festival environment was certainly not the clubs of Chicago, nor was it the juke joints of down south, or the rock clubs, or the coffee houses that the blues had been presented in as well. And I think one reason that the festivals remained so vivid with so many people 45 years on was the fact that the festival produced a kind of culture shock to these. The audience was predominantly young white kids, young white hippies, really. And that there was this kind of culture shock. Yes, people had heard the records. Perhaps they'd seen Big Joe Williams at a coffee house or James Cotton at a rock club. But to see the musicians so relaxed and performing for one another as much as for the audience presented an exposure to the blues culture, which is the whole underpinning of the enterprise, that would have been absent from those experiences and that they hadn't really kind of realized existed in the way it did. If you trace the blues through the performers at that first festival, it's kind of incredible. You can go from Shirley Griffith back to Tommy Johnson. You can go from Howlin' Wolf to Charlie Patton. You can go from Lightnin' Hopkins to Blind Lemon Jefferson. Or you can go to the present and you can look at the burgeoning West Side sound of Luther Allison, Otis Rush, Magic Sam, and Jimmy Dawkins, not to mention things in between like the Zydeco Blues of Clifton Chenier. So for musicians that may have heard of each other but had never played together or actually interacted with one another, at the festival this produced what Dick Waterman poetically put as a cultural reawakening and, formation. And to these largely young white attendees, the 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival represented a definitive crash course on the blues and the idiosyncrasies of the performers and the performances, the interactions backstage, and the spirit of respect that permeated the whole affair all contributed to define a new generation's approach to the blues, one that transcended folk or rock and acknowledged the blues once again as its own art and tradition.
So we've gathered together some of what we find to be the more poignant comments from our oral history interviews for you to drive home its significance to the festival's attendees and its organizers. And I want to look particularly at Amy Van Singel's quote. Amy Van Singel was the co-founder of Living Blues Magazine and an attendee at the 69 Festival. She says, "It had to be told. The musicians had their say, and I think Ann Arbor was a key point. It really was, and it spread out from there." In the fall of 1969, just after Ann Arbor, the Chicago Blues Festival had its first run. And early the following year, the Wisconsin Delta Blues Festival followed with a second iteration of the Ann Arbor Blues Festival in 1970. And as many of you probably know, there were many, many blues festivals to follow.
So really, in the end, we wanted to give the final word to the musicians who performed, since that was really what the festival was all about in the first place. And luckily for us, Michael Erlewine, who founded All Music Guide, did a number of interviews backstage, and unfortunately the audio is lost to time, but he managed to transcribe some of the more poignant bits and comments about the festival, and we have some of those to share. And you can see it focuses a lot on sort of the community in particular. You know, the festival is a big family reunion, says Lewis Myers, who played with Charlie Musselwhite, or James Cotton talking about how he'd never seen anything like this in his life. Magic Sam, the festival is like an all-star game. And I particularly like Roosevelt Sykes talking that following spring, so he has a little time to reflect, performing at a preview show for what was going to be the 1970 Ann Arbor Blues Festival. And he says, "Oh, we had some kicks, the musicians. That's one thing they didn't know. They should have charged musicians a fee. It's worth it for us to see one another. You know what I mean? We really enjoy one another that much." And so I think it kind of talks to the whole spirit of the enterprise, of the endeavor, of the festival, and sort of the lasting impact, the kind of connections that were made between musicians and musicians, between musicians and audience, and between the organizers and the musicians and the organizers and the audience. It was sort of one of a kind, and you know, those who attended the 1970 festival said it was spectacular, but it didn't have the same kind of energy as that first one. And it's hard to put a pinpoint on that energy, but something was there. So with that, we'd like to thank WKCR again, and particularly the team of workers who helped with this project, Ben Young, Joanna Farley, Malcolm Culleton, Joel Gombiner, David Beal, along with ARSC attendees who have helped us along the way with this enterprise, and also all the generous musicians and fans who have shared their time, expertise, and memories. With that, I think we've run out of time, so we can take questions after the fact.
Thank you. Okay. First, let me test the microphone. Yes, it's on. Okay, first of all, remember you can't sleep in tomorrow. Sessions start at 8:45. And now I'm going to rove around the audience and see if you have any questions that you'd like to address. Brad, you have to come up here. Well, I'll meet you halfway.
Okay. Thank you. Since this last presentation is fresh in my mind, if I could ask about that. My first question is, how did those tapes end up at Columbia University or KCR. Right.
They were sitting in our basement.
I see.
And I was going to Columbia and working at WKCR where this type of stuff. So my dad had this stuff in the basement and wanted to hear it. And I said, hey, would you, you know, they
give us your dad's name.
Jim Fischel.
Got it. So the connection really is your dad, not so much Columbia.
Exactly.
And are they still in your dad's? Oh, so they're in Columbia now. Great. With good temperature and humidity control, so they'll last a long time. Excellent. Did your dad not save a program? Was there not a program?
There is a program. I don't have a very good scan of it. That's the problem.
Okay, because it's curious that you're trying to reconstruct the order. I just kind of...
They didn't run according to that. I mean, if you heard that Bill announced, it was all over the place.
Okay.
And then what he announced was not actually what it ended up.
Okay.
Somehow it's disappeared, things like that.
Got it. Cool, cool. Okay, and are the files, you created digital files, are those also at Columbia?
They'll all eventually go there. Right now we have them in the cloud and on our own.
Great.
Backed up.
So thanks for your 5 years of work. Great stuff.
Okay, next, Steve. And when you answer the question, if you could, since we only have two mics, if you could stand up and go back to the mic so we can get it recorded, that would be great.
Mine's not a long one. I noticed Dick Waterman's name there, and I didn't see any Dick Waterman pictures. And he's sometimes very prepared. He really likes to keep his own pictures, if that's the word I want. So do you have any in the file? Has he given you any?
He's been helpful. I mean, I'm sure if we wanted to. Dick's been very helpful, and he's said that if we want to come down, the problem is a lot of his stuff isn't digital as of present, and he's going through his own sort of cataloging and organizing, so he doesn't have them readily at his disposal, but certainly he took wonderful photographs. There's actually, I mean, we used a lot of Tom Coppi photos, and he sort of managed to capture a lot of the beautiful backstage shots, but there are lots of wonderful photographs, whether they were on Brownie cameras, you know, 16-year-olds in the audience capturing them. But a lot of people, and then we found a lot of unpublished type materials as well, you know, people who we've interviewed who took snapshots. So,
and just to confirm, there's no film footage that anybody took of their own?
People remember people with cameras. We know that there was, strangely enough, a documentary on Jimmy Dawkins being made. Actually, one of the WKCR students who was helping with this project's father was part of that team. Which is a weird intersection. He doesn't have any of that footage, and he seems to think it's lost. We also know that Amy Van Singel and Jim O'Neill, who were a couple at the time, took some footage. They have a little bit of silent stuff of Luther Allison, like a very little bit, and they said, unfortunately, they did film Magic Sam, but it's too dark. It was in the evening, so it's pretty much black.
It's a shame it's pre-video days. Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes.
I guess this could be for either Mr. Doggett or Tim Brooks. You mentioned, Tim, English recordings. And I know that, like, Orpheus McAdoo had a minstrel show that toured South Africa, for instance. What was the influence of recorded minstrelsy or live minstrelsy in other parts of the world?
There was a very active scene in England, actually from the 1840s. That's where the Virginia Minstrels first went, like a few months after, and they really took to it. English recording, commercial recording, didn't really get started until the very end of the 90s. But at that time, you immediately got some English recording. So there's a whole discography of things there, continuing on through the black and white minstrel show that ran on British television until 1978, I think, which boggles the mind. I'm now in contact with some people in Australia to see what was done there. The archivist I was talking to thinks there were some done there. Certainly were tours to that area. But outside of the English-speaking world, Rainer and I were talking about this earlier, we haven't identified very much, and I'm not sure that it was very much out of the English-speaking world.
Great, thank you.
Just an immediate reply. The minstrel shows didn't mean anything to non-English speakers. Therefore, there were none in France, there were none in Hungary, there were none in Germany, but the American minstrel shows traveled all around the world from Australia to India to South Africa, and they were very well received there. They didn't make any recordings, but they were well received. And I can tell you that in South Africa, I found recordings by the first Jubilee singers. So that must be an immediate response.
Thanks. Also on the subject of minstrelsy, has there been any research done on the very peculiar practice of whiteface makeup used by clowns and in circuses, particularly since the two entertainment forms are almost running at the same time, the 19th century, the rise of these great traveling circuses? Is there any connection?
That's a thesis in itself. I know someone in who was, I think it's the City Museum of New York, who was a curator there, who's in Los Angeles, who specializes on the history of American circus acts and all of this whole thing. So I can actually ask him. He's published a lot of stuff, but I don't know that necessarily was the case. Of course, white facing by black entertainers was done more so privately, and also perhaps late as a sarcasm, but the prevailing thing was blackface. I mean, that was the whole thing. You know, it was burnt cork was initially, as I said with T.D. Rice, it really was part of an act, kind of as a Saturday Night Live, as Tim says, a subversiveness to poke fun at classism. Because T.D. Rice and others, all in the Bowery, these were lower class Irish immigrants coming to the Americas. And that would follow, of course, when the Great Famine of 1850, the 40, late 40s and 50s, more Irish immigrants would follow and come to New York, and looking at ways to make a living and survive, they would don the burnt cork and set and follow an example of T.D. Rice and others. But the white face makeup and circus, I can ask for that, and you can give me your information. I'll find out, because I'm sure I could answer that on behalf of this particular gentleman.
Thank you.
If I may, I can add that the impact of minstrelsy in South Africa was such that up to this date, there is the annual Coon Carnival, and they blacken up and they whiten up.
Hi, if I could just ask, at what point did T.D. Rice's individual performances become formalized into a three-act structure that it was kind of known for?
Well, Daddy Rice was an individual performer, 20s and 30s. The form, as I mentioned, was formalized initially in 1843 in that famous performance in the spring early that year by the Virginia Minstrels, and then morphed into much more elaborate stuff very quickly afterwards, and then metastasized after the Civil War. So the formalization of the minstrel show, and what most scholars consider the beginning of the minstrel show, not minstrel performers, but minstrel show, was 1843, and then from then on. I should mention, relative to the blackface, a number of performers, including black performers, I think Bert Williams, among others, have commented on, you know, what does he need to put on blackface? But it was a mask that allowed them to do things almost clown-like, which freed them from their own inhibitions, I guess, and let them do things that would look strange for a person in their natural appearance to do. So it's a complex field.
Okay, we're running out of time, so I'm giving the mic to our last respondent, and then we're going to have to wrap up the session.
Thank you. Well, I had a quick question. There was a lead, funny enough, we mentioned Australia and South Africa. In January, I was playing at a festival out near Sydney, and I happened to watch a workshop on English music hall, and I was surprised to see the iconography seemed extremely, very similar to, like, Joe Walker Sweeney's sheet music, or a lot of the iconography seemed very similar, at least how they were selling each of the characters. And when I was watching the workshop, a lot of those music hall performers, kind of like at the Archaeophone albums, you see the same thing, where they were a certain type of comedian, and then they created a character who was a naughty guy. He wasn't particularly a black guy in the English music hall. But it seemed like if you think of music hall as a thing that there's a whole circuit for it, it seems like, you know, these blackface minstrel show performers, once they create a character, they could travel via the music hall circuit. I was wondering if that's just a lead I saw, and I've just kind of gone on a hunch with it, but I was wondering if in your research, if there's been anything that you've seen that suggests retentions of English music hall and kind of like, you know, American theater trying to adapt English music hall, or, you know, taking that form and adapting it for American use, or, you know, with vaudeville or the theater. I don't know if there's anything that's ever come up with that.
Actually, I think Tim probably could do a good job on this as well, and I think both of us should answer this question. I can say, first off, that the review, the format of a musical review had existed in way back in the early 1800s. So it got formalized. I mean, how do I put it this way? Reviews or shows where there are multiple characters and multiple acts, that was happening in London almost at the time of Shakespeare, and certainly after Shakespeare. I mean, I've seen broadsides. I mean, one of my other hats has been as an antiquarian book dealer. There are broadsides by the thousands of all of these acts, these shows that have, like, if you will, they're precursors, historical precursors of the Apollo. I mean, you have all of these, you know, from being amateur to being professional, and all these people, there were bookers, you know, that would book all of these acts. So yes, that it also applied in minstrelsy in America as well as in the music hall, and I'm sure Tim can speak to a little bit more about that. But yes, so for example, I can just say Cicerita Jones, the Black Patty. She came, essentially, her booker, her agent, that got her all over Germany in the 1870s doing all of this German Lieder, so classical art song, German art song. She then went to London, but she, hoping to then continue with some of maybe the recital circuit, actually ended up finding the only way, because this whole comedy routine, this minstrel routine, this whole music hall review format was so much in demand that she got put in one of those, and she had this new book on Cicerita Jones that came out last year, this definitive biography that everyone's talking about, I'm having a senior moment of the author's name, but I can get it to you. You know, there was this quite a bit of a reaction that she had based on her letters to having to deal with this format of becoming this person who she was not. So that's a whole nother story, but let me let Tim chime in on this.
Sorry, I think we have to really wrap things up now because we have the, don't forget, the technical session at 7 p.m. tonight in the Paris Room, followed by the Collector's Roundtable. So we need to get people off to dinner. But let's give a final round of applause to all of our presenters. Thank you.